Good morning. Welcome back to those who were with us yesterday and welcome to those who are joining us. We are having a fully bilingual session this morning. Some of us will speak in English and others in French. Questions can be in any language because we're all fully bilingual. We are going to be looking this morning at the future of bioethics. My name is Vardy Krivitsky. I am a professor at the bioethics programs with Brin and Beatrice, and currently director of the Éthique et Santé, Axe Éthique et Santé de Créon. We all have historical links to Créon. Matthew was a postdoc. Brin was, and Beatrice were directors of the Éthique et Santé, and Brin was an interim director. So we're all linked to Créon in one way or another. Unfortunately, the main speaker that was planned for this morning, Professor Dina Davis, pretty well-known bioethicist from the U.S., could not make it because in the aftermath of Sandy, she could not physically make it to the airport. Gas stations were closed and she couldn't physically get herself to the airport. So what we have decided to do this morning is that I will present some points out of her paper. I will add a couple of points of my own. I will then invite my panelists to contribute 15 minutes of commentary each. We then will do a second round, like we did yesterday, in which each one of us will have 5 minutes to respond to the first round of comments, and the rest of the time will be open discussion and welcoming your questions. This format will leave us close to 45 minutes for the general discussion, which is very generous. So please prepare your questions and your insights. The future of bioethics. It's a fascinating question to address because bioethics in itself is a very young field of research and practice. Usually, when you look at the history books, and there aren't many because it's so young, the beginning of bioethics is sometime in the 60s when a combination of social movements and historical developments and technological developments brought up a whole range of new questions that the different disciplines began to address. Whereas in the past, questions related to the ethics of medicine were addressed by physicians in a very sealed manner, today numerous disciplines address these questions. Philosophy, theology, anthropology, sociology, economy, etc. Even if we look around this table, we come from different backgrounds, and we use different methodologies in our own research. So when we look ahead, what are the main challenges facing bioethics in the next decades? I invited two scholars to respond to this question, Dina Davis and Samia Hirst, and please read their full contributions in this wonderful issue. What I'll do now is summarize in a few words the points made by Dina Davis. What she's telling us in her paper is that whereas bioethics made a real difference in respect for personal autonomy, particularly through the concept of informed consent, when we look into the future, even though today the norms of medical practice have changed and medical paternalism, at least in North America, here in France it's different, medical paternalism is pretty much a thing of the past. It is established and acknowledged that various patients have different value systems, different desires, different preferences, and that the physician should really not make decisions for his patients, but rather for her patients, but rather either a shared decision-making model or a very strict model of autonomy in which patient alone makes the decisions. And we have established these norms in research, in particular, where the norm of informed consent for participation in research is, we'd like to think, established beyond any doubt. Davis tells us that these issues will still remain a challenge in the years to come in bioethics. Why? Because new forces are now working against informed consent, or threatening the autonomy of patients, and I will add of research participants. And these forces are not coming from a paternalistic model of medicine, or from a non-conscious researcher who doesn't understand that he's putting his participants at risk. It's coming from a new direction. And that direction is the pressure that we're all under to create a healthcare system that is efficient, cost-effective, and that uses opportunities that are presented to us to advance medical knowledge and to obtain as much medical information as possible. So this is a new kind of pressure, and as a result, it will create a new kind of challenge for autonomy and for informed consent. Davis gives three fascinating examples in her paper, one regarding adults, one regarding newborns, and one regarding fetuses. So basically, in all stages of our lives, we will be facing this challenge. As adults, we are living today in a reality where we're sometimes undergoing genetic screening tests without giving informed consent. A physician orders a blood test for a variety of routine reasons and slips in genetic screening, for example, for prostate cancer. It's a controversial test because the clinical meaning of the information is unclear. A very high percentage of men in the population will test positive, but that does not mean that they will become cancer patients or that they will need treatment, because this is a type of cancer that for many men will progress so slowly throughout their lives that they will end up dying from something else while having the condition, and it will never become symptomatic. However, once you screen and get a positive result, the medical system will recommend treatment. Treatment is very costly, and not just in economic terms. In many cases, it leads to devastating results for the patient, such as impotence or incontinence. So many men in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, still young, will end up undergoing treatment that will compromise significantly their quality of life because of a screening test they never consented to and were never informed about. What does research tell us about informing patients? It tells us that men who were fully informed about the screening refuse screening much more than men who, men who are not informed did not get a chance to refuse, but when informed, a high percentage of men turn down the opportunity to screen. So the impact on personal autonomy here is direct, proven by research, and the implications for the quality of life of patients when consent is not obtained is very serious. And this is a reality we're currently facing in a society where informed consent is supposed to be a completely entrenched notion respected throughout the medical system. The second example is better known, is the example of newborn screening. What started many years ago as a public health program to identify a small proportion of newborns for conditions that are treatable and for which the treatment is going to dramatically change the quality of life of the baby, and the poster child for this is a PKU, a condition that will cause severe cognitive delays and impairment in the child unless specific diet is started right in the beginning of life. So this was a case for which screening was absolutely justified. And once the system was put in place, today we're in a situation with many other conditions who are not treatable, where the clinical implications of knowing are not clear, are added on to the panels. And while we have established a norm of no parental consent for these tests, today all those new tests that we're adding on are still under that model of no parental consent. So each one of you who have had a baby probably was not asked after birth, do you agree for the state to screen your newborn? The test was done, and if you never heard anything, then there were no positive results, and if there were, you heard. But you were then faced with information that maybe you didn't want to know, and today probably you wouldn't know what to do with. So here's another example of, for historical reasons, a system that developed in such a way that today the right of parents to consent to tests on their baby, and in many cases today these are could be qualified as research tests and not as clinical tests, are done without your consent, without your knowledge, and then you're faced with a situation where knowledge is imposed on you, and many times you don't know what to do. And the last example is not here yet, but it's a technology that is coming, hitting us very fast, and that is prenatal diagnosis done through maternal blood. Today, in order to get genetic information about a fetus, we have to invade the uterus in a way that risks the pregnancy, amniocentesis or CVS. A new technology will offer us, potentially, full genome sequencing of our fetus very early in the pregnancy through maternal blood, with no risk to the pregnancy, no risk of miscarriage. What does that mean? Potentially, it means that when a woman sees her doctor for the first time, just to confirm that she's pregnant, when he sends her off, I know this is a bit of a science fiction scenario, but a lot of clinicians are actually afraid of what I'm about to describe. When a woman is sent off for her first blood test, just to confirm that she's pregnant, the doctor could add on, just check a box for full genetic diagnosis of the fetus. And at 8 or 9 or 10 weeks of pregnancy, when she's just realizing or coming to terms with the fact that she's pregnant, she will get amounts of genetic information about the fetus that are unprecedented, that we've never had before. And then, without consent, without a prior understanding of what all this will mean, she will just be faced with all these genetic predispositions, genetic risks for childhood diseases, for late onset diseases, many of them untreatable. This is the clinical prenatal reality that a lot of clinicians, genetic counselors, and patients are afraid of. And it's arriving fast. So Dina Davis calls all these scenarios opportunistic testing. We have a clinical reality that gives us an opportunity to test in a way that is very cost-effective, will help research, will help some of the patients. So we integrate it into the system while putting informed consent and, as a result, the autonomy of patients on the side. And she believes this is a great threat facing our healthcare system and our society in the future, and a great challenge for bioethicists. My own two cents onto this scenario is the issue of research. Because we're moving towards a model where research will be done in a very large scale and mostly on large numbers of samples through biobanks. And that's one of the hottest research ethics topics today, how to guarantee the respect of participants when they have actually given a sample, potentially some years ago, that is lying somewhere, maybe has been even de-identified and is now an anonymous sample. And what happens when researchers want to conduct a new type of study on that sample, on a disease that we didn't even know when the sample was obtained? And what happens when we identify a risk or some clinical, important clinical information in a sample, and we potentially have the possibility of linking it back to an individual and going back to inform that individual that they're at risk or that they should rethink the reproductive decisions, etc. A whole range of ethical challenges stemming from the idea that when we do research on large-scale databases of samples, maybe we can forego the notions of consent and the notion of informing participants, because this is a new model that requires new approaches. But then what happens when the knowledge that we obtain can be relevant to people's autonomy? So the same challenges raised by Davis's paper regarding the clinical realm are also very relevant in the research domain. This was my short summary of her argument. This is only one aspect of what bioethics will face in the future. And what I will do now is invite my panelists to contribute their own perspectives regarding future challenges to bioethics, either responding to this set of challenges or proposing something completely different. We'll hear all of them. We'll do our second round of reactions and then open it up to discussion, unless someone has an urgent clarification question.